If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
I didn't say you shouldn't like me. You're getting crazy. You're all off the subject. You said, I thought you was intelligent.
I'm not getting crazy. I'm not off the subject. You're throwing our faces that you're black.
I am black.
Everybody, we don't throw our color out at you.
You don't throw your color at me?
Well,
take that white Jesus off the wall.
And neither
take
do
them
you.
White angels off the wall. Every time I see Miss America, she's white. I know Miss America ain't pretty some black women I know. You lay in the sun trying to get color. They got pretty color. They got hips, waistline, pretty hair. Well, you trying to tell me you don't push yourself on me? That's all you push. Everything is white.
Hold it.
Everything
just a moment.
Everything you got is white.
Champ.
Tarzan, King of the Jungle. Tarzan, King of the Jungle, you made him white.
Yes.
You made Angel Food Cake white.
One of the many appearances of the great Muhammad Ali on the Donahue Show. Donahue that ran for 26 years on national television. Many of those years right from 2501 West Bradley Place on Chicago's northwest side, coming out of WGN Television. The Donahue Show that over the years took 20 Emmy Awards, scored a Peabody Award, TV Guide called Donahue one of the greatest television shows of all time. And Phil, with this disco theme music, how could it not be? Phil Donahue joining us on the phone line. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Dean.
How are you doing there, my friend?
Well, we're holding up pretty well. Me and all my buddies from Notre Dame just turned 80.
Oh, congratulations to you. I would have never guessed 80 years old. You are very spry for 80 years old.
Well, thank you. I think so.
So we've been, remembering Muhammad Ali this morning, and many of the clips, that we're seeing on YouTube, that we're seeing on television, that we're playing here are appearances that he made on your show. About how many times do you think Muhammad Ali was on your show?
Well, I'm going to say four or five. He was on, by the way, that was, people have asked me all the time down through the years. We did, we were on the air for 29 years. That comes to over 5,000 shows.
Wow.
And, of course, everybody wants to know, what's my best, what's my worst, what's my... And I always hated to answer that because I didn't want to offend anybody or maybe, damn somebody with my praise. But I'm so pleased that you picked that segment where the woman, Mrs. was in Chicago, in the audience. I'll never forget this, front row. How come you're always throwing your blackness at us? And his answer just, it left her breathless. And I always felt that was one of the most important moments of our 29 years. I have so much respect for Ali. I mean, I think what he did for billions of young men especially, around the world in terms of self-esteem, pride. He was the most famous Muslim in the world, to be sure. And, he said he was the greatest, and I believe he was. I think he was the athlete of the 20th century. And I'll never forget his appearances with me. I had the pleasure of visiting him in his ranch in northern, when he lived in northern Indiana. Am I talking too much?
No.
I should let you in here.
No,
Steve.
not at all.
I'm
happy to hear your...
if I sound enthusiastic about him, I am. I thought he should have won the Nobel Peace Prize. I still do. They stripped him of his championship. He wasn't going to fight in Vietnam. No Kong ever called me nigger. I ain't got nothing against no Kong. you know, to say that in the middle of the super heated war fever of his own country took an enormous courage, and he paid for it. He really paid for it, and he stood up and never blinked.
I was making that point to one of our callers, taking some calls as you did on your show, and somebody who said that they still kind of hold against him that he was, quote, a coward by not fighting in Vietnam when others went to Vietnam and others died in Vietnam, that he didn't, and stayed and made millions fighting people in the ring, beating people in the ring. And the point that I made is that there is a big difference between two people who who willfully go into a ring to fight each other and somebody taking a gun and killing somebody for whom you have no personal disagreement. And the point that he made where he said, I will probably be treated better by a Kong than I would in my own country.
There's a light year of difference between those two acts. Those young people who protested the war, I think we saw thousands and thousands of acts of real moral courage at that time. Dissent is still not easy in this country. I ought to know. but I haven't been penalized anywhere near the kind of abuse and the penalties suffered by Muhammad Ali. I was mentioning that not long ago, about 10 years ago, my wife wrote a book titled The Right Words at the Right Time. This was a compilation of essays by people who had a moment in their lives when somebody said something to them that changed them, that put them on a different course or had profound effect on their lives. And they were all celebrities. And the rules were you could write your own or you could have someone write it for you. And you would, of course, have final cut. And I wrote three of them. I wrote my own. And I said, my wife put me in her book. And I did Ted Turner and Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali at the time lived in a ranch in northern Indiana, not too far south of Chicago, and pretty close to South Bend, which is the home of Notre Dame, my alma mater.
Right.
So on one of the football weekends, I drove over to the ranch. And I pulled in, and in the parking area, there was a sign that said G-O-A-T. And I mean, I'm a slow learner. I thought, G-O-A-T, what is that? And it was much later I realized it meant greatest of all time. And Lonnie met me at the front door. I walked in. In the main room where you enter the ranch house, was a ring, a regular size boxing ring. A real boxing ring. And around the room were tall, almost floor-to-ceiling windows that exposed all the foliage, trees. It was lovely, really fabulous outside. And then in between the windows were life-size pictures of Muhammad. One was taken at the Olympics in Rome, and others of major events, major bouts that he had. And I stood there, and a door on the right side of the room opened. I will never forget this. And here he comes. The arms were trembling. And he's coming toward me. and he gets like 2 feet away, and he throws his arms out. And I moved toward him and put my arms around him, and he put his arms around me. I kissed him on the cheek, and I said, "How you doing, champ?" And I have never been this flattered in my life. I mean, I had so much admiration for him going in. He remembered his appearances on my show. The Parkinson's was just beginning to express itself. Lonnie was very, very much his guardian. She loomed over him. And we did the interview. And, of course, he's first in the book because, you know, Ali, eh? So it's only maybe, I don't know, maybe 1,500 words. And if we have time, it's up to you. I'll be happy to read it to you. But that's my Ali story, and
that's amazing.
I just couldn't get enough of this.
That's
guy.
Amazing. I have goosebumps hearing that story, and that's... That's profoundly moving to hear a story like that. What was he like when he was on your show? I mean, when he was on the air, you know, there was that Ali persona. But off camera, what was he like with you? What was the off camera Muhammad Ali like?
He was in some ways he was childlike. Had a very a fascinating sense of humor. You know, I would say, I mean, he never disappointed. I would say to him, "You're on one of the big shows now, champ. I bet you're nervous." And he would say, "I'm scared to death." And of course, the audience would scream. And at the end of the first show, this was in Chicago, this was at WGN, where I have a lot of friends. I'm a lucky guy. I mean, I returned there a couple of years ago, and I had a royal welcome. I felt very flattered.
We loved having you on the morning show. One of the highlights of our morning show was that morning that you were there with us, and we welcomed you back home.
Well, it was a real... It's a moment. It should happen to everybody. The point I was making is, on the air, at the end of one of our shows, we had gotten two pair of boxing gloves. And we both put gloves on. And we both stood up on the stage at WGN at the... Our studio was right next to Bozo. And we fought. We went at each other, and I wanted it to look good. And I mean, I'm swinging like a hockey fight. and boom, I knocked him down. And I said, you know, I'd throw my arms in the air, you know, like I just won the French Open.
All right.
And he knew how to sell tickets. I mean, you know, the audience was screaming. I just couldn't get over what a fabulous and bright showman he was. In addition to being, such a very bright political animal, you know. You made Tarzan white. I never thought of that. You know, I mean, and I was out there marching, and we had all the civil rights leaders on, and so I was reasonably current, and I pretty much had a pretty good grasp of what racism was, but I never thought about that. Holy cow. Johnny Weissmuller was white,
yeah.
And it never occurred to us that Tarzan was an African. And, you know, it still doesn't. Most of us white folks go to the grave without ever appreciating how we imposed whiteness on other people, which made that exchange that you played in the beginning of the interview.
There's another
so important.
Another clip from that same show where a woman stood up and said that that she is also a minority because she was from London. And Ali just practically, you know, shook his head in the air. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. You know, that that somebody was considered themselves a minority because, you know, that they were from another country compared to what African-Americans had gone through in the American experience. Phil, I need to take a quick break. Could I ask you to hold on for a moment?
Sure.
And we'll come right back with the great Phil Donahue next on WGN.
Bothering you. You look so...
I don't like his arrogance. I think...
You don't like...
No.
That's
because
I'm black.
No, sir. No.
You look like a... talking like this. The white people.
Oh, I bet... Listen, I beg your pardon. No.
I don't want to... All black people don't cut up what you say. You mean white people know. Listen, woman, everybody black watching this show knows why you don't like the way I talk. You don't like a... talking to you like this. Never done that like
sir,
before.
I beg you.
I know what it is. Don't tell me what you don't like.
I beg you.
You don't know
I'm
who you're talking
you
to.
I'm telling you what I don't like.
You know, I don't care what you don't like. Just buy a ticket and see me get my butt whooped.
No. Listen, I'm in a minority in this country here.
What's your minority?
I'm
what are you?
From England.
You're a minority. You're from England. You own England and America. You white. You can go into one of the city you want to go. Oh, you from England. You're more freer than me. You from England. Didn't you say you're a minority? You know you can go to towns, move in neighborhoods. You can buy things over. You can open a business downtown Chicago and do business, and I can't do it. But you from England. Now, you got some nerve to come over and be mad at me because I'm proud and I want to fight and be confident and get my people to be proud and fight and do. We the minority, too. We've been a minority for 400 years, and you freer than me. You from England. You are free.
Another clip from Phil Donahue's show, one of the many appearances by the late Muhammad Ali. And the great Phil Donahue, nice enough to join us live this morning to remember Muhammad Ali. Some of these clips, Phil, available on YouTube that we can watch. What was the general tone? I mean, these are a little bit hostile toward Muhammad Ali, but what was the general tone of the audiences when Ali was there?
Well, it was mixed. They were all wrapped. I mean, nobody, you know, they say nobody goes for a beer during a hockey fight, and nobody left the Donahue show when Ali was the guest. He was just very, very compelling. But there were, you know, vestiges of very old thinking that would surface in some places in the audience, and boy, he was ready. He was ready. He had an answer for everything, and he was always right. And it was just a fascinating human being.
Yeah, and you know, many of these early appearances were in the 1970s, when the war in Vietnam was still a fresh wound. There were still very polarizing feelings that people had then. So I imagine that. The things that he had to say then, it would be like when you had Jane Fonda on, you know, and people,
yes, indeed,
you know, criticized,
that's right,
Hanoi Jane, for what she did during the war.
Yes, we had a lot of those guests. We had sponsors cancel, and we took our share of incoming. We put a gay guy on in 1967. I mean, what? And, you know, nobody was out in 1967. And, I mean, we lost a lot of sponsors. Mothers thought their children would catch it, you know, if they watched it. So it was a really a wonderful, wonderful ride. I would wish it for anybody I love. It was, we felt very, very blessed to have had the opportunity to actually talk with so many people who had something to say and who achieved in their own field, lots of movie stars, all the presidents, And I had my name on the show. It was a real ego trip. If it sounds like I'm bragging, I am.
Well, you should, because, just before our news, I was explaining, for some of our younger listeners today, what the Donahue Show was, and, how, there might not have been an Oprah show if there hadn't been a Donahue show. There might not have been Ellen DeGeneres. There might not have been, many of the kinds of daytime talk that we see now had there not been Donahue, that you really pushed the envelope. You were, a real groundbreaker in what you did then. So you should be bragging about it. It was pretty amazing, a pretty amazing broadcasting back then.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I got a lot of help.
I am fascinated by your personal relationship with Muhammad Ali. We can see what happened on the air. It seemed like he had a really good sense of humor. I could tell. I think I could tell when you were interviewing him and trying to ask questions that there was a playfulness between you two. Am I gauging that correctly?
No, that is true. I mean, he knew how to verbally spar, and he knew what was funny, and he knew how to, put me on and get the laugh. I've always been impressed. Not everybody can tell a joke. Everybody can laugh at funny things, but not everybody can provoke a laugh. And he could. And, I just was always, always impressed by that. You couldn't insult him. He knew. I mean, all you did was set him up, and he would hit it right out of the park because he was so clever and his mind was so fast.
Was there a certain amount of preparation that went in, like the kinds of questions that you would ask in pre-interviewing? I got the sense that you pretty much had free rein to ask and talk about whatever you wanted to talk about with him.
Oh, yeah, there were no rules. I would have a producer put down articles or notes or, on my desk and say, now don't screw this up. I worked hard on it. And so I would, normally if the women, the producers were women, so I would carry the responsibility of them, of their hard work, into the studio. I wanted it to be a good show, not only for me, but for them. It would, they got their ego was gratified by a show that they produced that turned out really well. And Ali always did.
I need to take another quick break. We'll come right back with Phil Donahue next on WGN. This is going to be the best day of my life. It's 12:18, and this is Dean Richards, 720 WGN. Great Phil Donahue on the phone line with us, remembering Muhammad Ali. But this must bring back some of these WGN names here, Phil. Going into the break, we had a promo for Tom Skilling, who I believe was doing the weather back in the day when you were still at WGN. Does that ring a bell for you?
Oh, yeah.
Our weatherman, Tom Skilling?
Sure. He had just made his first communion.
That probably is very close. Just last weekend, we had a big ceremony out here in Pioneer Court outside the Tribune building. And the son and daughter-in-law of your old friend Bob Bell, who played Bozo on WGN,
they were here.
I'm friends with the Bells. And every once in a while, we get together with some of the longtime employees, now since retired from WGN from when you roamed our long cinder blocked hallways of WGN.
Well, that was a wonderful. I spent 8 years at WGN, and I grew up in Cleveland, so I grew up with the Indians, And, you know, our hero in the late 40s and 50s was Lou Boudreau, 24-year-old player manager, shortstop, who all he had to do was walk in from the shortstop to the mound to pull a pitcher. And at the end of my program at WGN, I think we aired at 10:30 in the morning, I would say goodbye to the audience. I would get in my car and drive down. Is it Ashland or Addison?
Addison.
Going down to Wrigley.
To Wrigley Field. Straight shot down Addison, right?
Yeah, Addison. And I would park. And that in those days, the Tribune Company not only owned the newspaper, but they owned the Cubs and Wrigley Field.
Right.
And I would park my car at the curb, wave at the cops, walk in the press gate, and go up to the booth and sit and watch the game with Lou Boudreau.
How about that?
I mean, this was a fantasy. You know, when I think of how much when I played baseball, I tried to copy his stance at the plate. In those days, the outfield and infield would throw their gloves on the field. Most of your viewers are too young to remember. And run into the dugout and prepare to bat. I would throw my glove on the field. I was second baseman. I throw my glove on the field just like Lou Boudreau.
Fantastic.
And here I am sitting there watching the game with Lou Boudreau and Vince Lloyd.
I can only imagine what a thrill
for me.
Yeah, when Ron Santo joined our broadcast team here at WGN Radio. I mean, I grew up as a kid watching Ron Santo at Wrigley Field, and when he became part of our broadcast team, you know, I couldn't believe that I knew Ron Santo and Ron Santo knew me. And when I would go up to that same press box that you were going up to, and would stand there as Ron Santo would broadcast the game, I had the same surreal feelings that I couldn't believe that I was standing there as it was happening.
You know, I went to the Cubs camp. You know, the place in Mesa.
The fantasy camp, yeah.
Out in Arizona.
Yeah.
Where you go and try not to act your age.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the Cubs were there. It was run by Randy Hundley. Gene Oliver, who caught Gibby for the Cardinals, also played a big role in this. But, you know, that was a big kick, especially – you know, after practice, you know, I caught, like, you know, because I'm such a tough guy. And by the second day, I couldn't walk. And I remember asking Jody Davis if he could squat. And he said no. I that's where I learned what a punishing position the catcher has.
Yeah.
But, oh, it's the best position in all of sport. I mean, you got the whole field in front of you. Nobody, you know, nobody throws that ball until you throw down the signal, the sign. And, you know, to have that kind of power for at least a moment was a big deal for me. I enjoyed it.
I can imagine. Another WGN memory for you was meeting your wife Marlo in the hallways of WGN. And I understand that you and Marlo just last month celebrated your 36th wedding anniversary. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. 36 years. We were married at her home in her parents' home in Beverly Hills. Her father was Danny Thomas, who, as you know, founded St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. No, I'm still on the phone.
Is she telling you to get off the phone?
No, she wanted to know if I still was on.
Oh.
I'm sure if she was here, she'd want me to say hello for you. My father-in-law raised his, you know, he founded St. Jude in Memphis.
Exactly.
And he raised his glass and he said, "I haven't lost a daughter. I've gained a fundraiser."
That's right.
That was 1980, so that was 36 years ago.
Still going strong. Still going strong after all these years. What are you doing now, Phil? You know, we miss seeing you on the air. We miss your very important voice.
Well, thank you.
What keeps you busy these days?
Thank you. Well, I made a documentary. Took a long time and a sinful amount of money. It's a shame, really. It shouldn't be that expensive. But this was the story of a young man who went to... It's an anti-Iraq war documentary. And it's the story of a young man who went to Iraq. And he was there 5 days. And he took a bullet from a rooftop, came down, it went... entered his shoulder area and exited T4 on his spine. So that's between the shoulder blades. He was paralyzed from the nipples down. He was like a rag doll. And I just couldn't get over. I met him at Walter Reed, and I just looked down at this young man, 24 years old, prime of life, can't walk, can't cough, impotent. And I thought, you know, people should see this. I thought this was the most sanitized war of my lifetime. I mean, the president said you can't take pictures of the coffins, and the whole press corps said, okay. And I felt, you know, if you're going to send these young men and women to war, show the sacrifice. Let the people who you've risked your life for see what price they're paying. And so I chose myself, and Milo and I flew to Kansas City after he had left Walter Reed and talked to him about it at home. And I said, his name was Thomas Young. And I said, I want to show the harm in harm's way. I want people to see up close, but I can't do it without your permission. He said, I do too. So it took 4 years, and we won a lot of awards, but alas, we sold no popcorn. This is not a take your girl to the movie movie. It's rough. I mean, people come out of the thing pretty wobbly.
Yeah, I recall when you were here in Chicago, the last time that you were here, it was for the release of that film, Body of War, if I'm remembering correctly, right?
Right. And we played a downtown theater, I can't remember. And the woman who helped me with this film, Ellen Spiro, and I did a Q&A afterward, and the place was jammed. Man, I thought I was Fellini. And, you know, the next day there were, you know, 19 people in the theater.
Yeah.
We didn't have the kind of money that it took, you know, Hollywood uses to promote a film. And, you know, it's just, it's a very tough movie. And Thomas spent 10 years trapped in bed. I mean, it's just beyond awful.
Yeah, it's a very compelling
last
story.
And the last time I saw him was in Portland, Oregon. And he died last year. A very, very sad story.
Very sad.
It was a spiritual experience for everybody who put this together, and I'm glad I met him.
Speaking of Q&A's after documentaries, a couple of weeks ago, the great Norman Lear was here in Chicago. There's a documentary on his life and career that's coming out next month. And I had the honor of hosting the Q&A with Norman Lear and the directors of the film here in Chicago. And it's amazing. His story is amazing. But he had mentioned to me that he was trying to get you to run for a political office. Is that true?
Well, there was some noise about that. You know, I don't know. 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, it was a while ago.
Certainly not raised. I'm a little old for that now. You know, I thought I mean, I thought I could do more, make a bigger footprint, you know, doing what I was doing. The show, for example, The Daily Show did really, you know, we won all the awards, the Peabody, Hall of Fame, all of these. And then I hit a wall at MSNBC in the late, in 2002. I had a show and I opposed the war, the Iraq invasion, and that really did not sit well with the a memo was published by the New York Times, an internal memo at NBC, which said that Donahue's anti-war stance will not do well against the flag waving on the other station. And so shortly before the invasion, I was let go. And that was, you know, that was a quite an experience. It certainly, it keeps me from a very large ego.
Well, you're, you know, very articulate, intelligent, and reasoned voice, I think, is missed by a lot of people. Dare I ask what your thoughts are about the presidential race going on right now?
Well, I mean, it's the best thing that ever happened to cable news. I am determined, I am convinced that Donald Trump can never be president. No one can convince me otherwise. And I'll be happy to wear the hair shirt if I'm wrong, but I really don't think I am. And I think the big story is, you know, who are these thousands and thousands of people who show up for his rallies and help him carry so many states that he's apparently going to be the Republican nominee?
Yeah.
What are they thinking and what is bothering them? And I think the Republican Party has a lot of self-examination and a lot on its mind. I mean, how could – I always wondered, you know, during the Tea Party thing and all the – you know, where were the reasonable Republicans? I interviewed all of them. You know, Mark Hatfield, Barry Goldwater was – a responsible, in my opinion, a responsible Republican. Nelson Rockefeller. There were a lot of them. And we never heard from them. They didn't speak up. Where were they? Why didn't they condemn this when it began? There are obviously a lot of very unhappy people in this country. There are a lot of broken dreams. There are a lot of people who didn't get the job or got the job and lost it because of a budget cut or whatever. And I think these are the people that are showing up to see Donald Trump. They're mad as hell. They're not going to take it anymore. And they're giving the middle finger to all establishment values and people and, Washington is filled with people who care only about themselves, and everybody hates Congress. And I think people who hate Congress are the same people who can't name their congressman. But nevertheless, that attitude is out there.
Yeah, Phil, I think this may be the subject of your next documentary.
Well, in a way, it's part of a body of war because we show the debate about the Iraq War in 2002, and it's amazing how shallow it is.
Phil, I have to
recommend it to your attention.
Yeah.
It's visible on Netflix and other
body of war. Yeah. I have to break for news, and I know that our time with you is up. I really appreciate you joining us. Your memories
okay,
of
Dean, thank
Muhammad
you very
Ali.
Much.
It's always great to talk to you. I'm glad to hear that you're doing so well. I remain a huge, huge, huge fan, and give our love to Marlo as well. Thank you.
I shall. All right, Dean. Thank you very much. I enjoyed the hour.
Thank you. The great Phil Donahue, WGN.